Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The foreign exchange markets are part of the global economy, but Washington only has eyes for Beijing. So Tim Geithner took a trip today to sort out the currency wars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 22nd of October. Good to have you with us. The place to be this weekend, if global economic policy happens to be your thing, is Seoul, South Korea. Finance ministers from the G20 industrialized countries are meeting about currency values in part. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, as you may know, hasn't had much luck in convincing the Chinese to change their approach. So he's going to try something new in Seoul. Our Washington bureau chief, John Dimsdale, has more.
The industrial leaders do agree a trade imbalance exists. Some countries export too much, some countries import too much. Secretary Geithner is proposing to set limits on those trade gaps. That means China would have to increase domestic demand for its own products and U.S. imports. How? Raise interest rates on bank deposits is one way, says the American Enterprise Institute's Claude Barfield.
Chinese consumers really get very little or no return, almost a negative return. You could also put a lot of money into the social safety net. You could cut taxes.
But the fastest way would be for China to increase the value of its currency. And Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says Geithner's using a back door to get a result he couldn't achieve through the front door.
When we were talking about the currency, it was China, China, China. When we're talking it this way, it's a little more neutrally phrased in hopes that it doesn't provoke quite the same level of confrontation and rhetorical sparks.
Except that Geithner's new strategy also hits other countries with export surpluses, including allies like Germany and Japan. They're telling the U.S. there's no way they can change domestic consumer behavior, at least not quickly, says Dartmouth professor Matthew Slaughter.
It takes a long time for policies and incentives to be altered for how companies and families operate.
Slaughter expects that if there's agreement at all among the G20, it'll be a very general set of goals without any enforcement or benchmarks along the way. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's a rare instance of government regulation having an almost immediate impact in the marketplace. Congress, as you may know, has been looking into for-profit colleges. Lawmakers in the White House want restrictions on federal financial aid to places like DeVry and the University of Phoenix. Well, the for-profits start reporting their profits in the next couple of weeks, and we got a preview not too long ago when the University of Phoenix warned enrollment could drop as much as 40%, in no small part because of government regulation. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Shares of for-profit colleges have plunged by as much as 50% in the last year as investors flee amidst a slew of bad PR and the threat of tougher oversight. Analyst Trace Erden at Signal Hill says education stocks have been trading in line with payday lenders. They took a hit when Congress overhauled financial regulations.
The market has decided that these universities are the equivalent of payday lenders, and that's how they're being valued right now, which is extraordinary because they used to trade at a premium.
To the industry's critics, it's an apt comparison. They see for-profit colleges as predators loading up low-income students with debt they can't pay. The Obama administration has proposed rules that would cut federal aid for programs whose graduates aren't likely to earn enough to pay off their loans. Erden says the latest stock decline was fueled by one company's efforts to get ahead of the regulations. Apollo Group, which owns the University of Phoenix, said recently it's tightening admission standards and will no longer pay enrollment counselors based on how many students they sign up. Investors didn't like it a bit.
What they've suggested is that the days of enrolling six or seven students with the hopes of hanging on to one are over. And they're really looking to be much more like a traditional school. And in the short term, that creates a tremendous amount of uncertainty.
Analysts aren't expecting such dramatic news from DeVry or Corinthian or the other companies reporting in the next few weeks. Pauline Abernathy is with the Institute for College Access and Success, a student advocacy group. She says in the long run, investors in these companies may have to settle for smaller profits.
What the students will see will be higher quality programs at charges that they can afford to repay. Shareholders may have to start no longer expecting a 37% rate of return year after year.
The Obama administration has delayed finalizing the so-called gainful employment rules until next year. It'll hold public hearings next week. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This next story comes with a disclaimer of sorts. You hear me make it every day. Marketplace is produced by American Public Media, not NPR. So we approach the Juan Williams story with no inside information. The longtime NPR news analyst was fired Wednesday night for violating NPR's ethics policies. For public radio stations, the timing and the ensuing backlash are less than ideal. A lot of them, as you may have been hearing on your station, are in the middle of their pledge drives. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Juan Williams clarified his controversial remarks on Good Morning America.
If I'm at the gate at an airport and I see people who are in Muslim Guard who are first and foremost identifying themselves as Muslims in the aftermath of 9/11, I am taken aback. I have a moment of fear.
But many Muslim groups were outraged by the comments, and NPR took swift action to terminate Williams. That controversy led to another one. People upset by the firing threatened to withhold public radio contributions. And this is fall fundraising week. In Austin, KUT's general manager Stuart Vanderwilt says he's heard from about 50 listeners.
Some are expressing concern, some are seeking more information, in a few cases canceling their support or informing us that they will not be contributing to the station.
The complaints didn't affect KUT's fundraising, but the Williams fallout could have other consequences. Some politicians have called for cuts in NPR's federal funding. Less than 2% of NPR's revenue comes indirectly from federal sources. Most funding comes from member stations. But at rural stations, federal funding can account for close to 40% of revenue. Andy Brimmer is at crisis management firm Joel Frank Wilkinson Brimmer Catcher.
You don't pick a fight with someone who has a very large bully pulpit. And Juan Williams obviously has a very large bully pulpit.
Williams has reportedly signed a deal with Fox News for a figure large enough to fund the annual budgets of many public radio stations. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not a whole lot, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pretty much every big economic story this past week has been about one of three things. One, corporate profits. Two, a subset of that, bank profits. And three, a subset of that, how the foreclosure paperwork mess might put a hitch in numbers one and two. Heidi Moore is here with us for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Also, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
I am obliged, I think, much to my dismay, to talk about banks because they're making a whole lot of money and they're tied up in the foreclosure mess. I mean, Heidi, what's the sense from the center of the monetary universe as to how the banks are doing?
Well, actually, in many ways, they're actually doing worse than they were last year. I think what we've seen is the banks are doing well in some businesses, but the really major businesses where they used to get their profits, things like retail, where they provide credit cards and banking to regular people like you and me, those businesses are all much less profitable now. And what that shows is that the free money offered to them by the Fed, those zero interest rates, has started to not work anymore in terms of goosing bank profits. So it's good in a way. The banks are now on their own and they do have to fend for themselves. But it's bad in a way because we're still stuck with those 0% interest rates. And maybe it's time to rethink that.
So do we have here, Sudeep, a tale of two economies, right? You have companies, generally speaking, making some money. You have banks kind of hanging out and then the rest of us are not so well off.
Absolutely. There's still this big cloud, though, over the big banks around their outlook. They might be making money now, but people don't know necessarily how they're going to get hit by more regulation, whether it's the U.S. regulation that's being implemented or international rules that are coming on board. And you just have to come back to this big concern that after a financial crisis, you're not going to see the banks recover very quickly. It took several years in the early 90s. It's taking several years now. And you're not going to have the rest of the economy recover while you're waiting for the big banks to pick up. And when you add all these other problems onto it, like this new foreclosure crisis, it's going to hold them back for a couple more years.
Mm. Okay, so Sudeep, fold in this new foreclosure crisis to the banks and how they're doing and where we might be headed.
Well, a few weeks ago, you saw this issue really flare up, and the bank stepped in, halted foreclosures, and now they've come off of that. They're restarting the foreclosure process, but a lot of the damage is already done. You've got the legal wrangling, some of it very appropriate, that started. And so 6 months from now, you're still going to be talking about the lawsuits and the attorney general's investigations around foreclosures, and you're still going to be talking about working through this big mess in the foreclosure market, which is now worse than it seemed before. And in a few months, you're already seeing it now, but you'll be talking about how house prices are entering a double dip and dropping again. And that's going to hold back the rest of the housing market. It's going to hold back a lot of the economy. You can't have a full recovery in the economy until you have at least some stabilization in the housing market. And we're not there yet.
I don't want to be talking about that stuff in 6 months. I don't want to be talking about it now. Heidi?
In many ways, you have just captured what has been up until now the denial phase of the five stages of foreclosure grief that many of the banks and the New York Fed and the Washington Fed have been engaged in. And I think that actually what's been going on now with foreclosures, where the New York Fed is actually leading a lawsuit against Bank of America for bad mortgages, really shows progress in a way that we're actually trying to do something about the problem. Unfortunately, mortgages are still the most volatile thing affecting all parts of our economy right now. And so if you think about that scene in Reservoir Dogs, where all the characters are pointing guns at each other, those guns right now are foreclosures. And the banks, you know, basically banks are pointing it at the Fed is pointing it at banks, you have homeowners, you have lawyers. It is the tensest part of the economy right now. And so much of kind of higher finance and our future actually depends on how these foreclosures are treated on a day-to-day level, which is kind of incredible to think about.
Just for the record, that was a Quentin Tarantino reference on a business and economics program talking about the foreclosure mess. I think that was, worthy of a round of applause, frankly.
There should be more. Usually there are David Mamet references, right. But anything violent will do, really.
Yeah. Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Heidi Moore up in New York City. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
And now, let's do the numbers. Well, the stock market ended things with a split verdict. The Dow stayed in the red most of the day, gave back 14 points today, down about a 10%, closed at 11,132. The S&P 500, on the other hand, floated 2 points higher, 0.25%, ended at 1,183. The NASDAQ did a little bit better, finished up 19 points, 0.8%, 2479, the number. That rings up, by the by, the third weekly gain for Wall Street. The Dow and the S&P each picked up 0.6%. The NASDAQ rose 0.4% higher. Never mind yesterday's earnings announcement from Amazon. Wall Street analysts decided they'd rather see the online retailer doing better than that, lifted the stock by 2.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. By the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering 4 sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at Vanguard.com/public radio. We'll be right back. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for September. The Federal Reserve and the FDIC hold a two-day conference on mortgages and the future of housing finance. And Homeland Security professionals from government agencies, contractors, and technology service providers are in Arlington for a border management summit. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the first election cycle since Citizens United, the Supreme Court's ruling earlier this year that unions and companies can spend as much as they want on almost anything they want in politics. They only rarely have to disclose where they are getting that money from. There are competing stories in a couple of big papers today. The New York Times on corporate contributions to the Chamber of Commerce. Also, the Wall Street Journal on big money union spending. To help sort out what all that money might actually be delivering, we've got Dave Leventhal of the Center for Responsive Politics on the line. That group tracks money in politics. Dave, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So there were these competing stories today in the Journal and the New York Times looking at the source of a lot of this external money in politics this election cycle. I'm wondering, though, what the real story is, whether it's amounts or anonymity.
It's a story of both, and we can show you lots of examples of organizations coming in and spending hard dollars on advertisements, radio, TV, newspapers, and we are seeing an unprecedented amount of money from outside groups coming into congressional elections and in spending, in some cases, millions of dollars on single congressional races. But a lot of this money, we simply don't know where it's coming from. We know that organizations are spending it. We know that groups are definitely using it for political purposes. But if you ask the question, well, who are the source donors? Nobody can give you an answer based on the way that disclosure laws in the United States now read.
There is a definition issue here, right? We are talking specifically about outside groups. That is, not political campaigns, not the parties, but organizations, in theory, external to the political structure.
We are talking about a number of groups that are spending millions, if not tens of millions of dollars in messaging and independent expenditures that have no direct relation to a political party. Now, some of these groups, you recognize the name very easily, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Service Employees International Union. Mm-hmm. But others, you don't necessarily know a whole lot about. American Crossroads GPS. Common Sense 10. Sometimes you have these organizations that have very vague or innocuous sounding names, but yet at the end of the day, you still don't know at all about truly who is fueling and funding the political efforts that these organizations are going forward with.
Correlate money and winning for me, can you?
Oftentimes, it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
However, what we have found is that the candidates who are spending millions, if not tens of millions of dollars of their own money, typically lose. You may or may not have heard of Jeff Green, a Democratic U.S. Senate candidate in Florida. He spent, at the end of the day, probably upwards of $20 million for an effort in which he was obliterated by U.S. Representative Kendrick Meek in a Democratic primary. Didn't even have a chance to advance to the general election. And we see with Meg Whitman in California running for governor. We see with Linda McMahon running for the U.S. Senate in Connecticut, them spending incredible eight, even nine-figure sums with Meg Whitman, yet they are having a difficult time in the polls. So in this one particular instance, money does not necessarily equal victory.
We're still a long way from 2012, but you have to believe it only gets worse, I suppose, from here.
You think it's crazy now? Wait 2 years. Wait a year when presidential candidates, certainly on the Republican side, are going to be doing just this for all the primary and caucuses that they're going to be running in. Congress certainly has the opportunity to come and pass a law that could force disclosure in one regard or another. And they did try this year with a bill called the Disclose Act. It ultimately stalled in the Senate. But absent that, you're looking at a campaign finance landscape that has been incredibly changed and something that is absolutely going to go forward in ways that perhaps we can't even imagine right now.
Dave Leventhal, he edits the Open Secrets blog at the Center for Responsive Politics. Dave, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you amp up on your way into the office every morning with a swing by Starbucks for a non-fat double shot latte, maybe you'd consider stopping in on the way home to unwind with a glass of Merlot, perhaps. This past Monday, Starbucks started testing alcohol on the menu at a store in Seattle. Ann Dornfeld has the story.
I'm walking into the Starbucks on Olive Way in Seattle. So far, looks like the usual suspects. Pissing espresso machines, lemon pound cake in the pastry case, guy in front of me who can't figure out what to order. But what's this? A display of enough beer and wine to start a party. Chris Ensko is Starbucks Regional Vice President for Operations. He says the company decided to experiment with liquid depressants right alongside its usual stimulants because the chain gets most of its customers before 11 a.m.
We saw this as a business opportunity, and I think we've thought about this for a long time, but this was a real opportunity to test it.
Starbucks has already tried alcohol on the menu of two of its Seattle stores that don't bear the Starbucks brand or logo. Now, for the first time, it's putting beer and wine on the menu after 4 p.m. at a Starbucks-branded store. Branding expert Rob Frankel doubts turning baristas into bartenders will pay off.
There's an old adage in show business, you know, singers want to be comedians and comedians want to be singers. If people want late hours and wine, I don't know if they're going to be going to the same place they get their coffee.
Frankel says the move harkens back to when Starbucks experimented unsuccessfully with hot breakfast items. Customers weren't too thrilled about the smell of ham and eggs. Frankel says Starbucks threatens to turn off customers this time with awkward situations where people get carded in line or cut off after too many pilsners. He says that could undermine the company's family-friendly brand. So maybe it's no surprise that Starbucks chose Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood for its trial run with alcohol. It's an area full of drinking establishments and the young people who love them. Markhale Moody Burks and a friend have just stopped by to check out this new, boozier Starbucks. They walk in, look at each other, giggle, and walk right back out.
It's kind of weird because it's Starbucks and it's a corporation, whatever, and I always feel kind of guilty going there anyway. But then it's like, well, I go there for my coffee. I don't really want to go there for my beer and wine, too. I just feel kind of dirty.
Other customers were more enthusiastic about the idea. Jessica and Eric Ryko are big Starbucks fans. They drove here from the suburbs to have beers and a cheese plate. Still, Jessica says it felt odd to drink at a Starbucks.
You know, if I'm having a beer, I want to be able to be loud and have fun, but it's not really the place to be loud. There's people doing their homework on their laptops and things, and people, you know, in groups talking quietly, and I just kind of felt like, you know, it's fun to have a beer, but I'd only have one, I think.
Starbucks says they'll be listening to customer feedback like this before deciding whether to put alcohol on the menu of the Starbucks near you. In Seattle, I'm Ann Dornfeld for Marketplace.
McDonald's has survived the recession better than most other restaurants, better than most other companies, in fact. The burger chain announced this week it's seen sales rise for 30 consecutive quarters. That's 7.5 years and a whole lot of Big Macs and fries and Cokes. In fact, McDonald's is doing so well, some managers are even rethinking the competition, not who they are so much as what they charge. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
Yeah, sure, there's Burger King and Wendy's and any other international chain of fast food restaurants competing with McDonald's. But if you're running the world's largest hamburger chain, think of your competition as something bigger than the restaurant next door. Think the refrigerator.
The refrigerator started to become a big competitor of ours.
That's Peter Benson, McDonald's chief financial officer, in a conference call with investors. He says McDonald's has done well during the recession, but it's undeniable more people are eating out less. So Benson says the company began looking at how to get people out for meals.
We started to look also at, you know, food at home, what's going on at the grocery stores.
Benson says the restaurant is looking to base its own prices on both its fast food competitors and the supermarket aisles. As a result, McDonald's will be raising prices in the U.S. and Europe. Peter Soleil analyzes the restaurant industry for Telsey Advisory Group.
The price increase will be a very nominal amount that the consumers will see on the menu price.
Soleil says given McDonald's history of cheap menu items, the company will be conscious not to raise prices too much Andy says it's not just the Golden Arches that's feeling a little more comfortable raising prices now.
Our price is going up at McDonald's. Yes, our price is going up at, you know, their competitors at, you know, Wendy's and Burger King. Yes, our price is going up in the supermarket. Yes.
Soleil says McDonald's is in a secure spot for the near future, especially as the menu continues to expand to include healthier options. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals, on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note to wrap things up this week, a detour from the headlines to talk about the tidbits that didn't get a whole lot of attention. It is, as always, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
A Guinness beer.
A perfect story for the weekend.
As always, although this time I'll be talking about Daphne Guinness. She's the heiress to the Guinness beer fortune. She's one of these starlets, like a Paris Hilton.
Sure, she's a celebrity in pubs all over.
All over. She's been sued by her neighbors. They want her to stop taking baths.
Does she live in a commune?
She's reportedly overflowed her bathtub one too many times.
You realize that the judge rules in the neighbor's favor, there are going to be 10-year-olds all over Manhattan filing for injunctions.
Delessi Michalis, web developer, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, a company called Sandvine just released a report that says 20% of all internet traffic in the evenings is due to Netflix streaming videos over the internet.
People watching movies on Netflix are 20% of internet bandwidth?
Yeah, the company still ships DVDs by mail, but they're really going after the online business.
Wow, so this means only 80% of the internet is now pornography.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's startling.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
All right, Jersey Shore, Lady Gaga's meat dress, the Mad Hatter, Playboy bunnies.
The decline of Western civilization.
That is an excellent guess. But it's actually a list of Yahoo's most popular costume searches this Halloween.
Really?
Yeah, and there's one also included, Chilean miners.
They're just going to put their kids in the basement for 3 months?
Yeah, which is nothing but candy.
There is oh so much more of what Rico and Brendan can do in their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and there is a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And on that note, and on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow gave back 14 points today, slipped about a tenth of 1%, but the S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ advanced 19 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what is rich?
If your neighbors are putting in $10,000 refrigerators and $15,000 washing machines and dryers, $250,000 would seem like that's not a lot of money.
Making $250,000 a year and where that puts you. We'll be back right here on Monday afternoon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.